you know, Nuh, sure, Prophet Abraham, you know, Moses, Jesus, whatever.
Yeah.
These are all Islam.
Islam.
But Al-Islam is this one.
This one, the package.
The one, the final revelation.
Yes.
You know, the Deen al-Haq, which was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in the Quran and in his Sunnah. Okay? Yes. Following Thaqalain.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
So, this, what is this Islam, Al-Islam? It is a package for the your perfection. Part of that package are rules.
Mm.
Ahkam.
Yes.
As it relates to you as a person, rulings, individual, yes, and as it relates to society. In fact, one of the beautiful things that Imam used to always point out, he said, the relation in among the rules of Islam, and remember, Imam Khomeini was a faqih. He was a legal scholar.
Yeah, legal scholar.
He was a marja.
Yes.
He has books and books and books and books.
Supreme jurist.
And books as a jurist.
Mm.
So he's not simply, you know, a guy who gets up on the member and, you know, does which is not a bad thing. I'm simply saying
But he's the expert.
His field of
expertise was law.
Law. Okay? He's a mufti. He's somebody who issues fatwas.
Fatwas.
Okay? So, a part of that package, a very important part of that package, is laws. And as Imam was pointing out, which is the important thing that we have to remember, is that he said the relation within laws, Islamic laws, the relation between laws that relate to society and laws that relate to the individual is 100 to 1 on the side of society.
Society, yes, exactly.
Because because of the Western influence and because of, you know, the negative influence that came from imperialism and cultural imperialism,
sure,
you know, we wanted to turn Islam into what Christianity had become, which is this personal thing, and forget about Islam, the social...
As the social thing.
And the social aspects of Islamic laws.
Sure.
That, you know, let the government deal with that.
Mm.
You know, the government who will get together in their parliaments and, you know, decide what is... The wise men will get together and you know, tell us what the laws are. And so one day, you know, having two men being married is illegal, and the next day it's legal.
Mm.
For example. Okay. I'm just giving an example.
Yeah, no, I mean, exactly.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So, that's not the case in Islam.
No, it's
Islam
not.
Has rules for society. When you have somebody who's a murderer, proven to be so in a trial, where there's, you know, appeals and multiple appeals, and there's strict rules of evidence, and there's all the things that all legal scholars consider to be a proper judicial procedure. After this proper judicial procedure has ended, and there is a final verdict that this person is guilty of murder, then there is an execution.
Exactly.
Okay? Mm. And no parliament can change that.
No. No.
Okay?
Yeah, just because of an election.
Right.
Exactly.
You know, certain definitions of what a family is, those are the definitions of what a family is.
Exactly.
And, you know, I just want to point out here, I think for the people for our listeners in the West and the Western Muslims, this is interesting. We suddenly see everybody going nuts. Oh, no, you know, for example, you know, same-sex marriages. Oh, that's also marriage.
Mm.
So why not, you know, a man and three women is, you know, as in the Islamic, a man and four wives.
Well, why is that?
Again, we're talking about consenting adults, each one choosing to do this. Now, we're not talking about forced marriages, which is un-Islamic.
Yes.
Forcing anyone into a marriage is un-Islamic.
No,
it's against Islamic laws, and you will be punished for it.
As consenting adults, which is what they refer to in terms of this gay marriage.
I'm using the same standard.
Same standard. Mm-hmm.
Why is this bad and that's good?
Good.
They say, well, it's a marriage is between two people. So who said? If you look at the history of humanity,
we didn't have
that. The majority form of marriage has between one man and multiple wives.
Multiple.
That's actually been the main way that people have been married. If you look at throughout history, and if you look at different, you know, groups around the world, that's actually been the dominant way of having marriage.
Exactly.
And families.
Yes. And the chief normally had the most women.
Right. And that's why Islam came and reduced it. The four is
reducing
it.
He had to reduce it.
Right? It's not about... you know, people are like, oh, why are you guys talking about this stuff? We're talking about the fact that you have this Deen al-Haq.
Yes.
It's a package deal.
Yes.
It's there for the perfection of your soul. Perfection of your soul, a big part of the perfection of your soul relates to your social life.
Exactly.
And your family life.
Exactly.
And how you interact in your society and your community and your nation and the world.
Absolutely.
It's not about you just being in your, you know, quiet corner with your, you know, oil lamp, you know, doing prayers.
Yes.
That's not what it's all about only. Yes, that is a part of the perfection of your soul, doing your ibadat, doing your prayers with God. Okay? But there's other aspects to it. This is where Islam comes in and talks about that.
Sure.
Okay? A person like Imam Khomeini, who is a religious authority, whose word is hujjah in the Ghaybat Kubra for us, says, you can't have this like you mentioned very nicely, this is cafeteria Islam. Let me just explain cafeteria. There's a term in the West called cafeteria Catholic.
Yes.
Because they were referring to Catholics who would, as though they are in a cafeteria where they can pick and choose whatever food that they want and put it on their tray. Okay, that's where the expression comes from, is that you go into a cafeteria
and you just choose whatever
you prefer, and you just put things on your plate.
And
you're this is what I like from Catholicism. You know, the abortion. No, let's have the abortion. You know,
yes.
And so this term came about in Catholicism. You can't be a cafeteria Catholic. It's a full package.
It's a full package.
So you can't be a cafeteria Muslim.
No.
And say, you know what? I like the prayer part. I like the fasting part. I don't like the jihad part. Don't tell me to go to.
Yes.
And it's interesting. We have many ayat where it says, you know, the minute the command of jihad comes to you, you start making excuses. Your eyes start rolling. You get this. You know, these are ayat from the Quran. These are not things.
And doesn't God condemn?
And he says, you haven't.
Doesn't he condemn that if you don't turn up in the battlefield to fight for your religion?
Right. He says, you know, the color of your face.
Yeah.
The color of your face changes. You suddenly start making excuses.
I pray to God our faces don't change any color.
Again,
because
so
I really want to go 11.
We're addressing this first and foremost
to
ourselves.
Yes, I really want to go 11. I want to get there as quickly as possible.
Well, there might be other battles.
Right? Thank you.
I'm saying that, you know.
I'm so happy to hear that.
We're addressing this in the first place to ourselves.
Yes.
We're not trying to say that we're better than anyone.
No, not by any means.
The point is that, you know, this is what Imam was teaching us. He was saying that you can't be a Muslim and then deny criminal punishment for a murderer.
That's right.
What does that mean? Okay, and you say, isn't it barbaric?
Eye for an eye go for, you know?
Listen, they go, isn't it barbaric these days? Why can't we just put him in jail?
Come on.
You know what the answer is? What's more barbaric? A person makes a mistake, they're whipped half an hour, you whip them.
And that's it.
They go home. Or you take that person, you put them in jail for 2 years.
2 years.
They lose their job. They lose their insurance. The kids without the father.
Father.
The wife without the husband.
Husband.
Everything, the whole life of the family.
Is
even
ruined.
Though, even though it's, forget about 2 years, 6 months in prison.
6 months, yes.
The whole life of a family is destroyed.
Destroyed.
Because of the mistake of one person.
That's not fair.
Is that not barbaric?
That is unjust.
What's more barbaric? The person goes, he gets his punishment, he puts on his shirt, goes back home. And maybe the only person that finds out is his wife.
Exactly.
Not even his children.
That's right, because we're supposed to maintain
his dad or his father
exactly.
or his mother or his cousin or, you know, Uncle Lou and
whatever.
Uncle Jim. And
We're supposed to still maintain their
Aunt
honor.
Betty, whatever, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So what's more barbaric? You're ruining the life of an entire family because of a mistake that one person made in the you know, so-called civilized, let's put him in prison. Forget about how long the trial takes.
Forget about
everything is...
How torturous is that?
Listen, I'll give you an example.
Please.
There are truck drivers in the European Union, and they're poor fellas. You know, they're truck drivers. You know, they're not like rich guys.
Yeah.
Okay? And they'll go to the different borders, and some of these... smugglers will be like, okay, take this amount of cigarettes to this country, because there's different.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, we'll give you this much amount of money if you take it across the border, especially France and Britain.
Britain, yeah.
Because they have different rates.
Yes.
And they get busted. I'm talking about a, you know, maybe a quarter load of cigarettes in a truck. And then they catch him, and the guy goes to prison for a year as a smuggler. Right?
Yeah.
Is this civilized? The poor guy, he might have been desperate to get maybe €1,000 or £1,000.
Whatever, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
His offense is, you know, cigarettes.
Cigarettes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not a good thing, but also not horrendous. Not a huge catastrophe.
Catastrophe, yes.
But the law says you have to go to prison for a year or two, at least, minimum.
Minimum, yes.
3 years, 4 years, depending
on... And loss of job.
You lose your job. You lose everything. Your entire life is ruined.
Ruined.
This is civilized? Let me give you another example. Because they say, execution, we don't execute anymore. Execution is uncivilized. It's for animals. Really? The guy in Norway. Mm. How many people did he kill?
90, I think.
Whatever.
Yeah.
A lot.
A lot.
40, 50, 60, 90.
90, yeah.
How much did he get?
I think it was 6 years, was it?
20 years.
20 years, yeah.
Three square meals, internet access, TV. Mm. You know, jail in Norway is pretty decent.
Oh, is it? Is it? Like, oh.
You know, most people in the world would like to have that as their house. Right?
Right.
Most people on Earth would like to have Norwegian prison as the house that they live in.
Yes, I'm sure they do.
So this hewan, this animal.
Oh, yes, goes there.
Is going to go for 20 years.
And that's going
to
compensate.
And you know why? We don't have lifelong imprisonment in Norway. They said it's not civilized to you know, put a human being in prison for his whole life.
But what he did was human, was it?
What about the family?
What about the justice? Where's the justice in that? Yeah, exactly.
What about the
family? What about the 90 families that he's ruined?
What about the mothers and the fathers of those young people that he killed?
Yeah, and are often.
We're not talking about Muslims. Don't think I'm...
No.
This is not
Muslims.
This is normal.
Yeah, you were just talking about...
As a mother and as a father.
Father, yeah. And the kids that he orphaned. Come on.
What about them?
What about them?
So that's civilized. Mm. Not killing him. Killing him is barbaric. Right?
Exactly.
This is the point we're
trying
to make.
This is the kind of perverse world we live in.
We've come to a point in this world, and thank God there was people like Imam. Mm.
To put this...
Who
corrected this.
You know, unapologetically,
yes,
were saying, this is wrong,
this
and
is
Islam is right.
Right.
Right? Logically right. What according to human nature is right.
Right.
What according to human conscience is right.
Right.
Not simply because I say so, it's right.
No.
Okay?
That's
we're not talking about, you know, this Taliban-style Wahhabi caricature, organ-eating, you know, chopping off heads with a sword in the middle of the, you know, town square Islam. That's not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
They would love us, they would love the world to think that that's Islam.
No.
You know, Imam had this other sentence, we've mentioned it before.
Yes.
You know, so it's we're talking about the real Deen al-Haq, whether it's as it relates to these Wahhabi takfir caricature of Islam, or whether it relates to this kind of wishy-washy Christianity that we have now, or this, you know, crazy kind of Zionist Judaism that we have.
Yes.
Okay, this racist, you know, dry, you know, just purely let's just obey the rules dryly without even thinking about them kind of, you know, Judaism that we have today, which is not the real, you know, it's not the religion of Moses. Okay,
that's
the Zionism is not the religion.
Zionism is not the religion of Moses.
Prophet Musa, peace be upon him, would not approve you know, building separate rows for.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
For his own children,
no.
Because you know Palestinians are, you know,
yeah,
children of Abraham.
Yeah, they are. They're part of the same progeny.
Right. They're cousins.
They're descendants.
You don't discriminate against your cousins.
No, you don't.
Right. So. This is why we have a person like Imam talking about real Deen al-Haq, about the real religion of God, the final revelation, you know, the real path to getting to God, as opposed to this caricature, as opposed to this wishy-washiness. He had this famous sentence. He said, we have to make a revolution so that, God forbid, people don't think that Islam is like Christianity.
Fantastic.
He said, we're Muslims. Of course we have to have a revolution. Of course we have to stand up to, you know, a tyrant and who's being backed by you know, a imperialist regime,
yes.
Okay? He said, so God forbid people don't think that Islam is like Christianity.
Exactly.
Okay? We don't want to be like that. We don't want to be, quote, civilized, where a person kills 50, 70, 80 people and then gets 20 years, you know, free meals. We don't want to be a place where a person makes a small mistake, where the father of a family who is trying to support his kids, who is having difficult times. I mean, look at the lives we have today in Europe in terms of just... You've lived there, just as a man, as a husband, as a father, trying to support your family.
It's
how difficult
hard.
Is it?
It is very hard.
Where you're not cheating, where you're not being
it's very hard.
Stealing, where you're
not
doing fraud, you know, where you're not some you know banker doing billion-dollar trades on the computer and you know ripping off the world, you know. So the poor guy, he's a truck driver.
And the white-collar crime is never punished.
And they don't get the guy in the city of London or in Paris or in New York who's, you know, ripping off billions. You know, sending thousands and tens of thousands of people into the poorhouse because of the
and
stuff
making
that
them
he
homeless.
Does.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
And they get the guy who's smuggling, you know, whatever, 20 packets or 100 packets of cigarettes, and they put him in jail for 3 years.
Where's the justice in that?
That's civilized.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's civilization.
Yes,
we are the barbarians.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
Is that
that's what they want us to think.
Is that the case?
No, it's not.
I would clearly submit that, yes, if you look at the takfiri caricature, organ-eating, liver cutting out Islam. Mm. Yes, they're no doubt they're barbarians.
Yes.
But this, what Imam would taught us, this Islam, this complete package, where it includes everything. You know, jihad is not warmongering. Jihad is defending yourself. Self. It's justice.
It's justice.
This is what human defending nature does. You defend your family. You defend your home. You defend your city.
Sure.
You defend your nation.
Sure.
Okay? This is what human beings do. Real human beings do these things.
Sure.
So I think that's really the bottom line, that we have to see this as a package. And thank God, we thank God that we have leaders and had leaders like Imam who taught us what real Islam is.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, thank you very much indeed. On that note, that was a wonderful contribution there. I hope our listeners benefited from what we said, because there were some very, very important points in what you discussed there. But it just leaves me to say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
The bloody war in Yemen is back in the news. In recent weeks, the Saudi-led coalition has tightened the noose around the poorest country in the region. In late January, the coalition targeted a detention center, claiming some 70 people and wounding many more. It also hit a telecommunications center, knocking the country off the internet. The Saudis have speeded up their aggression since October, after the UN Human Rights Council voted to end its war crimes investigation following intensive lobbying by Riyadh.
So here we are again. People in Yemen who have endured years of horrific suffering, widely documented by the UN and Amnesty and others, have now been left without any kind of UN mechanism to either document or investigate those violations. So we all know that the UN system has failed them, allowing for a situation where bullying and bribing, corruption of the system has won the day. Saudi Arabia, the UAE and their allies shamelessly and aggressively lobbied states throughout their capital city and got rid of the Group of Eminent Experts, or GEE.
Yemen is starving to death. Almost every minute, a Yemeni child is dying of starvation. The impoverished country is also experiencing the worst cholera outbreak in recorded history. Against such a backdrop, the self-proclaimed champion of human rights has done nothing to stop this humanitarian tragedy. On the contrary, it's still giving military and intelligence support to Saudi Arabia and its cronies. Even congressional efforts have failed to prevent the White House from supporting the coalition.
It is long past overdue that Congress remove U.S. forces from Yemen, as recent circumstances only confirm. Today we have the chance to remedy our course of action and to do what the Constitution and justice demand. The situation in Yemen is dire.
When Joe Biden came to office, he vowed to end the war.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
But more than 1 year into his presidency, the U.S. keeps selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, which keeps using them in its indiscriminate attacks. Surprisingly enough, the Biden administration approved a $650 million weapons sale to Saudi Arabia, which consisted of 280 AIM-120C air-to-air missiles that will be launched from Saudi Arabia's fighter jets. While described as defensive in nature, the sale angered even some Democrats, who say the non-stop flow of weapons from the U.S., regardless of their categorization, will only fuel the conflict. In other words, despite his anti-Saudi rhetoric, Biden has adhered, like his predecessors, to the traditional role of America in the region, following the preferences of the Saudi kingdom and the UAE and selling them more and more weapons. Upon the outbreak of the war, then-President Barack Obama declared that he had authorized U.S. forces to provide logistical and intelligence support to the Saudis in their military intervention in Yemen, establishing a joint planning cell with Saudi Arabia. Needless to say, under Donald Trump, the U.S. continued its support to the coalition.
That's peanuts for you. Should have increased it.
Until November 2018, that support included refueling Saudi warplanes that dropped bombs on Yemeni civilians, including children. The Trump administration ended the practice after increased pressure from activists and lawmakers about Riyadh's brutal conduct in the war.
Today we tell the despotic regime in Saudi Arabia that we will not be part of their military adventurism. And today, maybe in the most profound way, 45 years ago, the War Powers Act was passed. 45 years ago. Today, for the first time, we are going to go forward utilizing that legislation and tell the President of the United States and any president, Democrat or Republican, that the constitutional responsibility for making war rests with the United States Congress, not the White House. Let us pass this resolution.
But Washington continues to provide logistical and intelligence support for the Saudis and plans to sell them billions in advanced weapons like precision-guided missiles. In 2019, Trump even vetoed a bipartisan bill which would have ended U.S. support for the Saudi-led military intervention.
So here we are asserting Congress's long-established responsibility in the oversight of our use of military force and also limiting Americans' engagement in this war, which has gone on far too long. I think we all agree. It's so sad. The president must sign this legislation. We're so proud of the bipartisan support, bicameral legislation that we will sending him to advance a peaceful, enduring solution to a horrific humanitarian crisis.
In the words of U.S. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, as long as we're providing intelligence sharing, spare parts, maintenance transfers, selling weapons, regardless if they're offensive or defensive in nature, or so-called offensive or defensive, we're going to see more violence. Since the beginning of the Yemen war, the Saudi-led coalition has been pounding the country with bombs, many of them supplied by the UK. In fact, London immediately expressed strong support for the Saudi-led campaign. The war saw sales of UK bombs for 2015 increase from £9 million to over £1 billion in 3 months. In September 2016, then UK Foreign Minister Boris Johnson refused to block UK arms sales to Riyadh, arguing there was no clear evidence of breaches of international humanitarian law by the kingdom in the war in Yemen, and that it would be best for Saudi Arabia to investigate itself. According to the UK campaign group, Campaign Against Arms Trade, BAE Systems has sold £17.6 billion worth of arms and military services to the Saudi dictatorship since 2015.
In fact, we sold £1.4 billion of arms to Saudi Arabia in 3 months last year, including bombs and missiles that could be used in Yemen. Given everything we know about the appalling humanitarian cost of this war, with innocent civilians caught between the Saudi coalition and the Houthi rebels, why does the Prime Minister think it's right to be selling these weapons?
In April 2019, The Guardian revealed more than 40 Saudi officers had been trained at prestigious British military colleges since the start of the Saudi intervention in Yemen. While the World Food Programme warns it cannot feed Yemenis properly because of funding shortfalls, the UK slashed its humanitarian aid to Yemen by half in 2021. All in all, both the US and the UK have been providing, arming, refueling and servicing Saudi warplanes, which have routinely struck weddings, funerals, apartments, markets and other civilian targets. Although the two countries have enjoyed exemption from accountability, that doesn't change the reality on the ground. They are both accomplices to war crimes and have blood of innocent people on their hands.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فقد كذبوكم بما تقولون فما تستطيعون صرفا ولا نصرا ومن يظلم منكم نذقه عذابا كبيرا
So they will deny you, disbelievers, in what you say, and you cannot avert punishment or find help. And whoever commits injustice among you, we will make him taste a great punishment.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing the 19th verse of the chapter. فَقَدْ كَذَّبُوكُمْ بِمَا تَقُولُونَ So they shall indeed belie you of what you say. فَمَا تَسْتَطِيعُونَ صَرْفًا وَلَا نَصْرًا So you shall not be able to avert nor get help. وَمَنْ يَظْلِمْ مِنْكُمْ نُذِقْهُ عَذَابًا كَبِيرًا
and whoever of you is unjust, we will cause him taste a great torment. The latest couple of verses we were discussing were only talking about the situation of the pagans and polytheists in the next world, how they will argument against the Almighty Allah, and how they will bring excuses in the next world. As you may remember, the previous verses said that on that day, the Almighty Allah will muster them, and also the things and the ones, the entities they worshipped instead of Allah will be brought by the Almighty Allah. And He subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Was it you who misled my servants, or did they themselves go astray from my way?" This is what the Almighty Allah asks the idols or the other entities except Him that were worshipped in the world. Their answer will be, we only take you as guardian. We wouldn't dare take any other guardians besides you, but the problem is that you did provide them and their fathers to enjoy till they forgot the message, and they were a people in perdition. And the 19th verse says that they have nowhere else to run. They will not be able to avert the penalties, and they will not get help. One of the sources they might think they're able to get help is from their fathers and their ancestors. I mean, these verses do not only put emphasis on the prosperity of these pagans, they also emphasize on the ancestors' prosperity. Because when a child grows up in affluence and wealth, it seems natural that in this case, he mostly discriminates against others, and he will not easily get rid of his comfortable life. But the point is that if you want to stick with Almighty Allah's commands, if you want to stick with your religion's programs, you need to know the religion needs sacrificing. على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter. حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
The commands of Almighty Allah sometimes need migration. Even you will be sometimes ordered to participate in holy war. Martyrdom is an inseparable part of defending the religion of the Almighty Allah. Sometimes accepting different kinds of deprivations, sometimes refusing to surrender yourself to the enemy. They are all the different problems that you have when you accept, when you want to stick with Almighty Allah's commands. And all of these go with the temperament of the rich people less, unless their personality is superior to their material life. These are the kinds of people that if one day everything is good, they thank Allah. And if it turns against them, they do not get upset, they do not get unsteady. In other words, they dominate their material life. They're not its servants, they're not the slaves of this life. They are not from long the Qawman Bura, as the Holy Quran said. Since a land which has no tree or flower plant is in fact corrupted and dead, it is called Ba'ir, and this is where the word Bur comes from. Therefore, the sentence وَكَانُوا قَوْمًا بُورًا, and they were a people in perdition, refers to this matter, that because of this luxurious life and forgetting Allah and resurrection, this group has been corrupted and destructed. And this is what has caused them not to be able to avert their penalties and not to be able to get any help. The 19th verse says, فَمَا تَسْتَطِعُونَ صَرْفًا وَلَا نَصْرًا. Studying nations that are blessed with this world's goods and know nothing of Allah and other nations makes the vast meaning of these verses more clear. Sometimes the lands of the hearts of people get empty of the flowers of the human values and they forget all about spiritual life. May God save us from these situations. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always let me worry, and that's when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
از پیغمبر اکرم یاد بگیر، پدرزن نان و گوشت رو پیغمبر داد.
In the wedding of Imam Ali alayhi salam and Hazrat Fatima salam Allah alayha, Prophet Muhammad accepted to buy the bread and meat for the ceremony and asked Imam Ali only to buy oil and date. In this way, he wanted to reduce the expenses of the ceremony, which were all on the shoulder of the groom, namely Ali. In fact, there was no pretentious formality in the wedding of the daughter of the Prophet of Islam, and many people were invited to the ceremony too.
الان تو جامعه متاسفانه داره این فاصله رو دور میکنه و شما میدونید این دور شده.
Now, compared with today's world, you can see how these formalities make families and friends keep away from each other. It also causes depression and sins like backbiting and slander among the families too. The relatives, because of these formalities, are apart and sometimes even they do not know each other very well. The main cause of this separation of family members and relatives is nothing but pretentious formality and takalluf. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
The day he started his presidential campaign, US President Joe Biden told the world that America wants to go back to Iran's nuclear deal. From that day, Israel started to threaten the world that if the US goes back to the deal, it would take matters into its own hands. So as the talks continued between Tehran and the P4+1 group of countries, Israel's voice of agony grows louder. Israel has launched a pressure campaign to make sure that the countries negotiating with Iran in Vienna do not agree to what Israeli officials call a bad deal, meaning a deal that allows Tehran to make nuclear bombs. The very idea of building a nuclear bomb is totally rejected by the Iranian government. In 2003, Iran's leader issued a fatwa that forbade the production and use of any form of weapon of mass destruction, which includes nuclear weapons. However, accusing Iran of going after the nukes is a strategy Israel uses to legitimize its hostile stance against Iran. The regime has even beefed up its military activities. In November, Israeli, Emirati, and Bahraini naval forces, for the first time, rehearsed joint security operations with the US warship. A month earlier, Israel launched a war game at a desert airbase just north of the port city of Eilat, which sent fighter planes from the occupied territories and seven other countries roaring into the skies. Israel also allocated $1.5 billion to prepare the Israeli armed forces for a potential strike against Iran nuclear sites. In fact, there are near daily warnings from Israeli political and military officials as well. In the latest move in a series of threats, Israel's Minister of War Affairs ordered his forces to prepare a military option. Benny Gantz warned the world that Israel would take matters into its own hands if a nuclear agreement did not constrain Iran the way Israel wants it to.
Recently, the chief of staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. The Iranian nuclear aspiration must be stalled. If the world stops them before, it's very much good. But if not, we must stand independently and we must defend ourselves by ourselves.
What Gantz said could be interpreted as a direct threat. However, there are multiple military experts in and outside Israel who believe Gantz's statement was nothing but an empty threat. Several current and former senior Israeli military officials and experts say that Israel lacks the ability to attack Iran. Military experts say Tel Aviv can't pull off an assault that could destroy or even significantly delay Iran's nuclear program, at least not anytime soon. Now, one might ask why carrying out an assault on Iran would be impossible, given the fact that Israel has the latest military weaponry, fighter jets, and support of the United States. True, Israel has a long history when it comes to air attacks, but it won't be as easy as it was when it bombed Egypt, Gaza, Iraq, Lebanon, Sudan, Tunisia, and Syria. Not easy, at least, without potentially catastrophic consequences. To be sure, one could not compare Israel's bombing of such facilities in Iran to its air attacks against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981 or Syria's Al-Kubar facility in 2007. Relik Shafir, a retired Israeli Air Force general who was a pilot in a 1981 strike on an Iraqi nuclear facility, said, "Bombing Iran's nuclear facility is almost impossible." Iran has dozens of nuclear sites, some deep underground, that would be hard for Israeli bombs to quickly penetrate and destroy. The fact is, the Israeli Air Force does not have warplanes large enough to carry such large bombs, so the more protected sites would have to be struck repeatedly with less effective missiles, a process that might take days or even weeks. The other obstacle is geography. If Israel decides to carry out strikes on Iran, its warplanes must fly over 3,000 kilometers to get to Iran. This would cause fuel shortages as the planes have to fly the same amount to go back to Israel. Israel has already ordered jets that can make such flights at a cost of $2.4 billion, but the aircraft are backordered and Israel is unlikely to receive even one before late 2024. There's also the fear of retaliation. Naturally, if Iran gets attacked, it will respond vehemently. Some Israeli planes would almost certainly be lost during the sorties. Their pilots would be killed or taken prisoner, and such losses would have huge consequences for Israel. Let's not forget that Iran is a country of nearly 86 million people, with the potential ability to mobilize its networks all over the Middle East to retaliate. From Lebanon to Palestine and Syria, pro-Iranian forces surrounding Israel could make the regime pay a huge price for any attack. Israel's famous missile system is no good for such a confrontation either. The Iron Dome was never tested in a real battle. It only intercepted man-made Gazan rockets, not real missiles or rockets. It's not even capable of intercepting those handcrafted missiles coming from Gaza. So, if a war erupts, it is safe to say that the Iron Dome can't be much of a help to Israelis. In the meantime, Iran has a formidable missile arsenal of its own capable of precision strikes, which can easily respond to an Israeli bombing of its nuclear sites by going after softer targets.
They always shoot at Israel rockets, but in 2004 or 5, people start to get killed. Make me very annoyed that we don't have a solution. And also, I remember even 91, when Iraq shoot missiles in Israel, we have no solution. You know, everything was... Tel Aviv was empty, okay? They shoot around Tel Aviv. And I decided that we have to do something. Although nothing had been done around the world, and everybody said it cannot be done.
One doesn't need to be a general or a strategist to find out that the declarations by the Israeli officials about Israel's readiness for a military strike are empty and pointless rhetoric. All you need is to look at the past few decades. Since January 1995, Israel has been saying that Iran is much closer to producing nuclear weapons than previously thought and could be less than 5 years away from having an atomic bomb. 27 years later, Israel continues threatening to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. And yet nothing, it's quite clear. Israel is just playing pretend.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way?
all covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din wal-Arzam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Before we deal with the law of miscellaneous nature, which is the topic today, and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, his eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hawza lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, let me ask you at the beginning of this episode about tattoo. Lots of people are very much fond of it, and you can see it everywhere. It's becoming a household term now. What is the status of tattoo according to Ayatollah Sistani?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Tattoos are generally permissible. According to all religious authorities, tattoos are allowed, you know. There might be some scholars who might be opposed to the modern the new forms of tattoos that are that we see on a daily basis when we have encounters with different people. You know, we see different designs, different shapes, and some of those designs are really, we can say, offensive to some people.
Yes.
But as a general criterion, Ayatollah Sistani says that tattoos are allowed. It was allowed in the early period of Islam, and it is still allowed So Islam does not or has not changed. You know, the religious authorities have no reason to change the law or the Islam, the law, the legal code of practice.
Mm-hmm.
So tattoos are permissible. Now there are some questions maybe popping up to your mind, to everybody's mind, whether tattoos, you know, tattoos of any kind are permissible. For example, there are different designs and shapes, and of course Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that tattoos